This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Inner Landscapes, the transformative character arc in speculative fiction.
Now, this week was suggested by Jules, and I believe it comes in response to some of the reviews we've been seeing of the recent Captain Marvel movie.
Yes, it got me thinking. When we say transformative arc, what we're really saying is the journey a character makes from the beginning of a piece of fiction to the end of a piece of fiction. In most cases, the character will not be quite the same person at the end as they were at the beginning. And obviously things like timelines and the things that happen to the character, the stresses and strains, all play a part in that. But yeah. There seems to be this idea that a character arc is reflected directly always by the action that is happening around them. And this isn't necessarily true. It doesn't have to be a case of you have to physically go from A to B. A transformative arc can be almost entirely internal as well and still be just as powerful.
Yes.
So when we say we're talking about internal and external character arcs, an external character arc might be the traditional hero narrative whereby young boy, unregarded by people, gets handed a magic sword and a destiny and goes off on a quest. And it's a very, very physical transformative arc. And he's definitely not the young boy who starts the journey at the very end of it. But an internal one can be something as simple as, I suppose the classic is the sort of coming of age tale, whereby not an awful lot happens action-wise outside in the story, but internally the character goes on a tremendous journey.
Yeah. And quite often, especially in very popular media, I say popular media as in things which have been regarded as having withstood, you know, the test of time, there is a nice balance between those two things. But usually the deciding factor is where the conflict lies. And is it an external conflict or is it an internal conflict? Now, as Jill said, in the example of young boy gets magic sword, it's usually has to go on a quest to, you know, if we look at the hero's journey, typically it's must go on a quest to receive elixir of life, which will save village from damnation. But there are ogres in the way. That's a very external conflict. So a lot of the character development and development in general is going to be external because they are trying to overcome these conflicts which are external. Whereas the internal conflict, such as in the case of the coming of age story, is about those things which are stopping you from as a person. So it might be insecurities, it might be a sense of worthlessness, all of these kinds of things. And through the overcoming of these internal conflicts, you are able to transform into what you are supposed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, we'll talk about Captain Marvel in a bit more detail later, but the big objection seemed to be that a lot of people, mostly male people I've seen, maybe there are women who are saying this, but I genuinely haven't seen any yet, are complaining that her character doesn't change throughout the entire story and that her character arc stays the same. And quite frankly, that's bollocks. That's just a case of, no, you have never learned to see what is actually happening there because you've never really had to deal with it. So, as I said, we'll go into it in a bit more detail later, but it does beg the interesting question of something Madeleine said before we started the show, which was gender differentiation and whether particular character arcs seem to attach themselves more to particular genders.
Yes.
In this case, people seem to think, well, you know, it's an action movie. It contains a superhuman. We expect them to start the classic superhuman origin story, the classic superhero origin story whereby someone starts with nothing.
Yeah, and then
discovers that they can become powerful, which is obviously not what happens in Captain Marvel, as we'll talk about later.
No. before we get onto that, and yeah, it's something that we both suddenly went, oh yeah, I think I just kind of want to unpack a little bit some of the ways in which internal and external development have been used. Now, just in general, and again, this isn't last rule, this is always the case, but as a general kind of way in which we tend to write, children's fiction from below middle grade tends to very much focus on external. It's external conflict, it's external development, everything that is even the conflicts which are happening internally also have internal conflicts, but these are almost always expressed externally. It's all about the action of what is happening.
Yeah.
And then we get into YA, where it actually kind of flips a little bit, in that you still do get a lot of this external kind of action happening, particularly in, you know, fantasy and dystopian and things like that. But it's also the concentration is then on the internal conflict. And I don't think it's a coincidence that in terms of YA readership, there is a massive YA readership tends to be focused more towards women. The YA books are read more often by young women than young men, and of course there are young men who read YA books too, but
yeah,
the general kind of readership, the audience, tends to be quite female, whereas middle grade there's still a relative balance, but it does that there does see this kind of discrepancy between genders, particularly male and female. There's obviously different genders as well. That's a whole other complicated issue. So just for this case, we're just going to look at the very basic male and female, just because that's the data that we've got.
Yeah.
So middle grade, there's a little bit more of a balance. Still tends to be more female readers, but again, and then YA, it tends to be women readers with some men. And then following on from that, if you also go into adult fiction and you look at genres where it tends to focus on internal conflict and internal development over external, you will suddenly find that actually there's this, again, this association between certain instance, period dramas. If you say a period drama, who do you think's going to watch it?
Well, generally you'd say it's more geared towards women. There are exceptions, obviously. But...
Of course, yeah, there are always exceptions. But yeah, I mean, let's look at Poldark, for instance. You know, the books and then the series. Big female viewership. And of course, there are men. We're not saying that only women. There are lots of people who enjoy it. But in terms of the majority, it is a female majority that I know of.
I was going to say, what's interesting about Poldark as an example is the books, when they were written, were aimed at men.
Yeah.
That was the audience. Admittedly, the books were written about 50-odd years ago, so times have changed.
Yeah, I think it's because definitely in the way that the story's been framed now, it's much more, I'd say it's much more suited to women. Consider the way it's advertised. Consider the way that, you know, the way they do the costumes, the way that they, the trailers and what they focus on and the steaminess and things like that. It tends to be, you know, it's kind of sold as this romance, you know, it's a romance. It's a romance.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I never...
And again, romance is another genre.
Yes.
Sorry.
No, what it comes down to is that 80% of the reading public are female, and we do have the stats to back that up, and there is a drop-off point between middle grade and young adult whereby boys just stop reading as much.
Yeah.
Not all boys, but certainly a good proportion of them. And it's something that the reading agency and the library services scratch their heads over every year. How can we get more boys reading, etc., etc.? And the really depressing thing, as a complete sidebar, and then we'll get back onto transformational arcs, is that people have suggested it's because we're not presenting fiction and character arcs that boys want to, that boys actually want to engage with. And the thing is, that's not true, because then if you look at it in reverse, 80% of literature and things that are produced with the default, the male reader or the male consumer in mind. So there's a real lack of balance there.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
But back to transformational arcs. You would tend to find generally that a lot of female character arcs seem to be much more focused internally.
The genres where you're more likely to get a female main character tend to be, again, genres strongly with women, such as romance, such as historical dramas, and even in some cases, weirdly enough, there's this weird thing about crime too, about women who love crime novels.
Yeah, crime kind of bucks the trend, because I think that's the one that's actually kind of read equally but slightly more by women. It's sort of a 60-40 split.
It's
read intergenerationally. That's not aimed at a particular... I mean, the sweet little old ladies who come into my library and then take home a stack of 12 Karen Slaughter books, which are incredibly gory, and they'll devour them over a weekend and come back for more. And it's just like, you never can tell. It really is funny.
Yeah. I think this is also the other thing, is that, you will tend to find... that when you have a book which is then adapted into a film, and Paul Dark is the weird one where it's kind of gone the other direction, you will tend to find that, obviously, because when you have a visual, it changes everything. So a story which focuses on an internal development is made into an external development when it to a film. I think probably a good example of that is the Hunger Games series.
Yeah.
Where particularly at the end, you know, there was a lot of internal trauma going on with the character of Katniss. You know, this was a character who had PTSD, who was really struggling, and there was a lot of political things happening externally as well, but there was a lot of internal things. Whereas the films, obviously, they wanted action. They wanted that internal struggle to be visual, so it became very external instead.
Yeah, it certainly does seem to cross boundaries, particularly with films. So looking at the actual transformational arc idea, internal and external,
yeah,
the thing is, you don't have to choose. You can have both, and a lot of things do have both, and they might have a front runner. So I have to say, every so often I will flirt with reading a romance, and I'm invariably disappointed. It just isn't my genre. It really isn't. Part of the reason I don't like it is that, for me, the way the two different sort of character arcs are done don't tend to provide something that's satisfying for me personally. But I know, I understand, you know, that all these other people out there reading it cannot possibly be all wrong, can they? So this is just one where it misses me. Yeah, I mean, we've said before, with genre fiction, particularly fantasy and paranormal ghost stories and things, the external should reflect the internal character, the internal of the character struggles. So that's part of the character arc. So you have the external, the action, or the spookiness or whatever, should be reflecting part of the character's internal journey, and the two should marry up quite nicely. And it's the same with a lot of other things. It's just, if you look at the Avengers films, for example, it's really, really obvious. The character journeys are generally really obvious because there's so much action going on. And then the internal side of that sort of reflects the action back again, which is why some of them are quite good and some of them miss for me, because I don't necessarily think people are thinking about how the two things marry up together.
Yeah, just sitting in the cinema like, I don't think most people are doing that.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, if you're just going along because you want to watch a firework display, that's fine. Or just because I love this character and I don't require them to have this many layers. I can get that from comic books. I don't need it in a film. I just want to watch a film and switch off. That's great. I will say that if you write for any length of time, you will not be able to switch off your internal editor. It just doesn't go away.
I think the thing with Marvel movies, and in particular it's Marvel movies with this, is because there is so much material about these characters, in terms of the comics, in terms of TV series, in terms of all of the other media which is available, it means that you can go into these movies and create your own internal, or sort of imprint your own internal kind of a conflict onto it. Because you know these characters, you know what they've been going through, so you can say that's what they must be thinking right now, and it's unique only to these superhero films, which are created as part of something much larger, which has come before them, and you can only really do it there. So I guess it also depends. If you're certainly if you're coming into these Marvel movies with no real relationship already with the characters, it could be a little bit jarring unless you are only going in, as Jill says, for that fireworks display. But if you're coming into it with that knowledge that you've already, you know, been given, that you've already sort of read up on, and a keen kind of understanding of the character, that internal conflict does exist, but it exists as a kind of subtext.
Yeah, I suppose part of the issue is obviously you have different writers working on different films. There isn't necessarily a single thread going through the entire thing. So as an overall piece of fiction, it doesn't necessarily work.
I will agree with that, and I am being kind, but I just do think that the problem is that you do need to have that kind of knowledge, and it's still up to you to sort of apply it. And I think that there are definitely some of the Marvel movies do manage to create an excellent sense of internal conflict as well, and I do think others are just there for fun, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just that if that's not what you're into, then that's not what you're into.
I wasn't actually aiming a massive criticism at the Marvel films, because I actually really enjoy them, but just as it was as an example, and as we've said, film prefers in many ways the external character arc, and when you have an ensemble piece, it's very difficult to get all those character arcs on screen at the same time. I mean, think about fact, well, I won't say it because we'll talk about it later, but that there are other examples of that sort of massive ensemble piece and trying to get all the character arcs assembled as well. But when you're writing, you can use internal and external character arcs in conjunction with each other. As we've said, you can use them in juxtaposition with each other. You can have someone who is going through, like, literally internal hell as they try and, like, remake themselves, and everything around them is really calm and sort of, I don't know, just as a random suggestion, someone discovers something about themselves that is utterly life-shattering. It's completely changing their entire viewpoint and everything they knew about the world. And yet what they're doing while all this is going on internally is perhaps they're helping out at the Women's Institute, and they're going along and running the church tombola, and everything's calm and very picturesque and very jarring. So there isn't a lot of external action, but the fact that that external action is so calm is sort of a juxtaposition to the trauma they're going through internally.
Yeah, which actually creates a greater sense of tension with that turmoil. And actually, as you say, that juxtaposition is a powerful tool. And, you know, because we talk about pathetic fallacy. Yeah. And that's only one level of it. But, you know, pathetic fallacy is the perfect example of when the external are matching one another. So you've got Jonathan Harker going up to Dracula's castle feeling kind of a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
Already you've got, like, the wolves and, you know, the storm, the fire, you know, this general, like, this very physical sense of doom, which is accompanying his internal sense of doom. And you get that all the time in kind of gothic fiction. And obviously that works because it's trying to create a whole general atmosphere. But by also by doing the complete opposite, you're kind of using the uncanny in a lot of ways. And because we have these gothic tropes, it's like when you think a funeral, you think raining, because you think sadness, and that's something that we have a very, very strong association with, because you want that, you want the internal to be external as well. But when you do something that's the complete opposite and you create that juxtaposition, it heightens the sense of unease or the sense of something wrong, which you particularly want with internal conflict sometimes, because it creates even more of that sense of isolation in some cases, but it also makes things feel trapped, like they can't even get that trauma out. They are locked in with it. So using it, it can create all sorts of different effects, and you can really create that uncanniness of saying, we expect there to be this particular outcome, we expect there to be this particular sort of external influence or an external kind of reaction, but it's not there. And the fact that it's not there, the fact that it's not just not there, but is all extremely the opposite of what we expect, really, really heightens everything, I think. Did that make any sense?
I think it made sense in my head. You veered a little, you sort of veered into setting and foreshadowing and tension and suspense. But basically what I got from that was that what a character physically does is the external, obviously. And if someone is, say, like Jonathan Harker, physically noticing that this, you know what, the Carpathian Mountains are kind of creepy, and it keeps playing on his mind, that's his physical character journey, whereas his internal character journey is, this is a big case, I might finally get a promotion and then I can marry Mina, etc., and start my new life. And that's his internal character journey.
The people in the village just told me some weird stuff and I don't know what's going on.
So the dead travel fast. And obviously all those things do feed into you can't just take tiny bits of writing and say, I'm going to do this and nothing else, because it feeds into foreshadowing and a lot of it's unconscious. But you can use an external character journey, as we've said, set up in direct juxtaposition to the internal journey, and that very sense of jarring against two different realities effectively can either give you a very claustrophobic feeling or a very sort of unsafe feeling as well, which is very effective. You can also just focus on a character arc singly. An awful lot of contemporary young adult fiction focuses mostly on an internal character journey, and any action outside of that is kind of incidental, really.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, I was not explaining myself very well, but thank you, yes, you've just laid it out. But it was, you know, when I was talking about obviously I was just using pathetic fallacy just as an example of saying external kind of things, but when it comes to sort of action, if you've got a character and, you know, suddenly they're in a position where it looks like they might physically get into a fight, you're expecting that. And then when they step down from that fight or they act very meek, you're like, oh, that makes me kind of nervous, because they haven't let that frustration out. So it's almost like something worse is now going to happen.
Yeah, there's a classic one really for jump scares in films, when they sort of hold it back and they hold it back and they hold it back, which is a different technique entirely, but it sort of feeds into the same thing. But it's really noticeable that films particularly really sort of jam off of the whole external character journey generally. Whereas a lot of the series and things that are being written now, particularly for things like Netflix, they don't tend to spoon feed you as much. And a lot of it is about internal character journey. If you think of things like Breaking Bad, for example.
Yeah.
And there are various other things. We've been watching something called Halt and Catch Fire. Again, lots of different things happen externally to the characters, but the internal journey is the part that's really important.
Yeah. And I think it all boils down to time.
Yeah,
Because exploring an internal journey takes time in order to be satisfying, usually. And because it tends to have, especially when you've got a long kind of thing, there's a lot of complexity that goes along with it. And it can be very interesting and very intriguing. And weirdly enough, we mentioned this gender disparity between internal and external. But psychological thrillers, for instance, will sometimes, well, not just sometimes, explore that conflict. And you definitely get some which are very external as well. But the internal kind of the change, the nuances, the complexity of what's happening, you know, it ties in with the genre. It's suited to that genre and it's very popular in that way. But I think that for the most part, you're right. When it comes to movies, it will, unless it's a very particular kind of genre, but TV series currently are doing more in terms of focusing stories where the focus is the internal conflict.
Yeah, definitely. Which is interesting because it wasn't that long ago when everything that was visual was pretty much external. I think it was things like Buffy that started really exploring the internal character development. And again, female character. So suddenly we're looking at internal character arc. And Alias, again, lots of action, but internal character arc all the way through those five seasons. And then you've got things like Battlestar Galactica, again, really looking at internal character arc, but I don't think it would have done if you hadn't have had those things previous to that, which showed that people would follow seven series of something.
Yeah.
If you provided them with a satisfying experience that was both external and internal.
Yeah. And I think it also comes down to character as well.
Definitely.
You know, if you don't have any internal development, then a character is going to get very, very boring. Now, and for the most part, when you've got a series or a long-standing series, you will have a character who has some kind of internal development. The exceptions to that are obviously mystery novels and sort of crime novels, but mystery novels in particular. Just talk Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock doesn't really change that much. Dr. Watson has a little bit of a change, but the fact is that they are literally designed to be the constants because everything around them is changing instead. So it is incredibly external because the whole point is the plot is external. And that's where the intrigue and that's where the difference is and that's where you get all this, you even get internal conflicts within the characters instead. But that's, I think, probably the only way in which you can have a very, very successful, long-running series of things which don't have a massive focus on internal. And I also think that in current adaptations of Sherlock Holmes and in current crime and detective stories, then they don't do that anymore, actually. For the most part, we do now have that internal conflict happening, usually with the detective at the same time. They're there solving the case, while inside they're trying to figure out, are they a good father or not, you know?
Yeah, and honestly, I prefer that. I've got a soft spot for Sherlock Holmes, but yeah. I really like to see character journey. Although Alan has recently, I say recently, Alan has been working his way through all of the Sharp novels by Bernard Cornwell. Bernard Cornwell writes a good book. I mean, if you've read his Last Kingdom series, Uhtred Bevenberg really does change. He's a completely different character at the end of that series so far than he was when he was a young boy at the beginning, obviously. But the Sharp novels are slightly different. The Sharp novels are what Bernard Cornwell started with. And Sharp in book one is pretty much the same as Sharp in book 15. And it's kind of okay because we love the character and everything else is changing. And even though there are so many constants that are the same, like, you know, Sharp starts from nothing, works is all the way up, becomes captain, gets awarded money and an estate, marries somebody. And then it doesn't reset, but something happens to destroy all that. I think he and his, I can't remember the name of his friend, the one who goes with him, It's gone out of my head, the big guy. But anyway, I think they start from nothing three times in that series, if I recall, and work their way up. And even though I was sort of reading them way, way back when I was a teenager, thinking, this is ridiculous, this is the third time they've done this, I fucking love it, you know? It's great. There's always this sort of vaguely gentrified sort of slash aristocratic bloke in charge who, like, doesn't really get what's going on, doesn't understand the common soldier, etc., etc., and Sharp always manages to make them look really stupid.
Yeah,
you know, it's an episode of something that people like, and there isn't really a lot in the way of transformative character arc in there.
No,
so you can have something immensely successful that doesn't really have a transformational arc at all, and people will still really enjoy it.
Yeah. But again, I do think that I think that the Sharp novels were aimed towards men, though.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, right. Let's look at some examples. So, since we've been talking about Captain Marvel, let's really look at what the problem with Captain Marvel was.
Yeah. So, I think the problem with Captain Marvel is that it didn't follow that same format that you get with what got with pretty much most of the other sort of original Avengers stories.
Yeah, there's no origin story. She doesn't start out with nothing and then get awarded powers. She has powers and spends the entire film being told that she's not powerful and that she needs the people she's working with and that she can't control it and that she needs to be not so emotional, when her entire character arc is about learning to accept the fact that she is powerful and she should be allowed to be emotional if she needs to be.
Yeah. And I think the interesting thing is that actually in that way, it is a very typical story structure for a superhero, in that she does kind of start out with nothing, or she starts out at kind of her very worst. And her very worst is the fact that she's deeply repressed by both the people that she's around and then by extension herself as well, because she's kind of been taught this behavior. And then she does gain her own power, and her own power comes from the fact that she turns around and realizes something about herself, which is that, no, actually, hold on, I can do this, and I don't need to change myself to hit the expectations of other people, or more importantly, so that I can be controlled by other people.
Yeah, and that's a very reflective story of general experience of being female.
Yes,
that's a case of, okay, no, actually, you do have power, you do have a voice, and you don't have to be a dick about it, but at the same time, you don't have to listen to everybody saying that you're worth less, that you don't deserve as much, and that your piece of the pie should be like divided up amongst other people and you don't really get anything.
Yeah,
so it's a case of, this is not a case of death to all men or whatever, this is just a case of, no, I deserve a seat at the table too, and I have my talents. I certainly don't have to win a fist fight with you.
Yeah. And I think that it was important because they could very easily have still used that internal development, that internal story, and sort of reflected it more externally by saying, by her gaining her powers, she realizes she had a voice all along.
Yeah. And they training could have done that. And having a mentor rather than an equal, which is what Nick Fury turns out to be in that. He treats her as an equal, even though she like massively outstrips him power-wise.
Yeah. But you know, they could have done that. But I think that it would have actually really detracted from the overall message of what they were trying to give, which isn't that that women can gain power. This was something that she already had and that was being repressed, rather than she was being repressed until she gained power and that's what gave her the ability. She already had it. And actually, in a similar way that, you know, that I don't get, is that you kind of get a similar kind of thing with Iron Man. And no one was complaining about it in Iron Man, right? Where, okay, he didn't have the Iron Man suit to begin with. What he did have was his brain. And he literally always had that, and he just had to be put in a situation whereby he suddenly had to go re-examine what he was meant to do And that allowed him to be Iron Man. But as the rest of Tony Stark's journey has been about, is the fact that he is Iron Man, regardless of whether or not he's in the suit.
Well, yeah,
similarly,
he basically grows a sense of morality, and sometimes it overgrows to the point where he starts like suppressing other people with his own sense of morality, and that's something he learns to prune back. So, yeah, it's a very similar journey.
It is, but no one complained about that. And I think it's because they just didn't recognise what was being done about this movie, and the fact that this was a woman who already did have everything, but was being looked down despite it, and not just despite it, but because of it, because it was something that was frightening, and it is an experience, it is an insanely personal experience that every woman I know pretty much has been through in some form or another.
Yeah, definitely. Right, I'm going to mention a book that I read last year called Ink Mistress by Audrey Colthurst, and it's a bit of a dark horse. I don't think it's been hyped as much as some other young adult books, but it absolutely should have been, and so should the author. Ink Mistress is about a demigod who lives apart from everybody else. She's kept quite secluded because she has a very dangerous power, and her power is that if she writes something in her own blood, it will come true. Right. So she could write something for the future and make it happen. She could write something in the past and it will rewrite the past. And there are people who would want to use that. She's not actually very interested in using her power. She just wants to act as a healer. And she lives up on a mountain and she's kind of involved with one of the girls who lives down in the village. But when the snows come, they can't see each other over the winter. She's, basically supposed to be living there secretly.
Right.
Now, this book got an awful lot of flack, and the reason it got flack was because it had a bisexual main character who, by the end of the book, ends up with a man. I'm like, but she started off with a woman, and it's never made a case of, oh, well, I was straight all along or anything. This is a case of, no, you guys are seeing what you want to see here, and what some of you want to see is the fact that, you know what, you're just as bisexual if you end up with a man as if you end up with a woman or someone who's non-binary, who you're with doesn't actually fundamentally change who you are. So that was annoying to start with. And part of the reason I read it was kind of like, no, I want to know what people are complaining about. But the book itself is told in a really quiet fantasy way, and it unwinds slowly, and it's got gorgeous prose. And there are action scenes in it, but it's not frenetic like some young adult books are, where it's literally action, 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 and there is absolutely no substance behind it at all.
Yeah.
And part of the problem is we've kind of trained people to believe that the whole sort of frenetic pace and only action and only girl warriors matter, etc., in a way that they then can't recognise how brilliant a character who is based on compassion, empathy, and like genuine affection and really wanting someone to love is actually just equally a hero and just as strong and has just as much agency. And Azra, the demigod's character journey, is really interesting because everything she does wrong in that book initially comes from her trying to help her girlfriend. Her girlfriend comes from a tribe of people who, by the time they reach their naming day, they should have bonded with an animal. And once they've bonded with that animal, they can then shapeshift into that animal. And her girlfriend hasn't. And basically, she cannot become a chieftain of the tribe if she doesn't ever shapeshift. And there are a few that are sort of nulls and never do. But, she loses all her status, which is unfortunate.
Right.
Azra's girlfriend manipulates Azra into writing that she will find her bonding animal before a certain time. And Azra loves her girlfriend and doesn't want her girlfriend to go into an arranged marriage instead.
Mm-hmm.
And basically she just gets used by her. She gets completely and utterly blindsided and taken advantage of by this girl that she was in love with. And it's only much later on that she realises that this girl didn't actually love her at all. It completely breaks her heart. And she creates the big enemy of the entire book because her girlfriend bonds with a dragon and then becomes this terrible destructive force that she has to hunt down. So, like I said, there is action, but a lot of it is sort of internally learning that just because she's been kept secluded and told to keep herself secret so she can't be used doesn't mean she doesn't have value. And it doesn't mean that because she loved somebody who betrayed her, that she again doesn't have any value and that she doesn't deserve to be loved. And that's what the entire book is about. And by the end of it, she met someone on the way who they both kind of let each other down a little bit, and then they finally come out at the end of it stronger. And it's a case of, no, I think it's actually okay to love you again. It's okay to be in love with somebody else. And that's how she ends up with a bloke instead. But
I think also the other thing is that when it comes to YA, there has been this very, very, I say depressing. I guess it's a little bit depressing for me, but other people may differ in that. The fact that all internal conflicts have been about romance, and in particular have been about not the romance that you're kind of describing, which is it's more of an established, I've had my heart broken. There's been a betrayal, but more along the lines of I am discovering romance for the first time. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. There really isn't. Some of my favorite books, including Unveiled, I'm just going to point out, have got these fantastic, internal conflicts which are about discovery and finding love. But in the case of Unveiled, finding love is not the only internal conflict. In fact, there's some other pretty significant internal conflicts happening at the same time. And I think that there is this confusion between saying, between not confusion, but rather there's this bad trend of just giving these female characters that particular form of internal conflict and only that particular form. Which just means that actually, when it comes to other internal conflicts, they're just not recognized, they're not seen, they're kind of perceived as being boring or strange. I don't know. I don't know. I
No,
also think
I think
it's
you're right.
possibly why some male readers will just be like, I'm not really interested in the internal conflicts, because up until that point, the only internal conflicts they've ever seen have been about romance, and them saying, actually, I kind of, I'm not really interested in a sort of a teenage girl going through romance for the first time.
And obviously you're right. I mean, we've trained people one specific way, and in Ink Mistress, it was a case of, I am actually strong within myself. It's actually kind of the same character arc as Captain Marvel, in the sense of I have value, I have power, and I deserve to take up as much space as I need to take up without ever being, overshadowing anyone else. I'm going to mention a film that is actually ancient. Now, it came out while I was at university, and yeah, this is a really clever one. It took me years to work this out, literally years, and I still hadn't worked all of it out. But this is one where they snuck in a really, really serious internal character arc, but they did everything with the external arc so well that most people never noticed consciously that there was an internal arc there to be accessed. And that's The Matrix.
Ha
The entire film is about the quest for identity, which
Yeah.
everybody at some point in their lives can absolutely gel with, I think, because there is, as a teenager in your 20s, actually at any point in your life, you might suddenly have that there's something wrong. I'm living this life and something is out of place, something doesn't work feeling.
Yeah.
And I think that's why the film spoke to so many people. Everyone loved the action scenes. Everyone loved the idea that there was this great revolution against machines. It's literally sort of sticking it to the man, isn't it? It's a classic
Yeah.
type character journey from the external point of view, but the internal journey is Neo wanting to be his true self.
Yeah.
And it was only a couple of years ago that I realised that the directors of the film were transsexual. And I was like, oh my God, the entire film's a metaphor for being transsexual. And it suddenly all clicked into place. And it was one of those moments where it was a case of, I knew this, but I didn't know I consciously knew it, because when I realised that bit, it was a case of, I kind of did know on some level, but I'd never really articulated it to myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then I found out a bit more about it. I mean, I'm not nerdy in this way. I mean, Alan, for example, will reel off who directed something, who was the producer, when it came out, et cetera, because he's a bit of a film buff on the quiet. I'm nerdy like that about books. I don't tend to necessarily think of directors and things for films. It doesn't interest me in the same way. So I actually went and found out a bit more about it and realised they'd actually made changes in casting and things like that. And it was supposed to be much more overtly about being transsexual originally, while still being a fantastic piece of science fiction and a great story about finding your identity and being your true self, about becoming. Yeah, that was an interesting one. And there is, if you go out looking for it, strangely enough, for The Matrix, there is stuff on the internet really, really well broken down who can do it far better than I can. But the whole idea of it being a metaphor for being transsexual is something that everybody can actually gel with. You don't have to be transsexual to access the idea that Neo's journey is a search for identity, because at some point in our lives, all of us will be searching for identity, or will have done so.
Yeah, absolutely. And but also not just searching for identity, but feeling very much as if something isn't right. I mean, that's the whole point of Neo, is that he just kind of goes, he feels out of place.
Yeah.
And he can't identify why until someone comes to him and says, so, hey, there's this thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can absolutely, if you only want to watch it as an external character journey whereby it's the man against the machines and I've learned kung fu, etc., etc., all the action sequences, great, that's fine. You can read it as just science fiction. But there's something very satisfying about getting that great external character journey and then realising there's an internal character journey to be had there too.
Yeah.
And whether you want to take that to the level of metaphor or not, but it was clearly very intended to be a metaphor for that particular journey within human life.
Yeah. I think, I actually, because I've realised that we're sort of running out of time, so I don't want to...
Yeah.
monopolise on it, but I do kind of want to mention another film, which again, not a new one. This one came out in 1991, I believe, and that is Hook with Robin Williams.
Yeah.
Now it's a fantastic film, and weirdly enough, there are a lot of parallels with it. But it's a completely different thing with the current Christopher Robin.
I've not seen it.
I can't remember, because there's two films about Winnie the Pooh which have recently come out, and one of them is about the reality, you know, the story of it being written, and the other one is about grown-up Christopher Robin.
Yeah.
re-meeting all of the characters. And that's the one I mean. And Hook is kind of, there's this massive internal conflict with Hook, in that you have this character who's kind of settled into life, and is not getting on well with their family. He doesn't understand his children, and he doesn't understand what they need, and he's very obsessed with work, and he's stagnating a little bit.
Which is absolutely massively ironic when you find out who he really is.
Exactly. And the whole thing for him is that is about understanding his children, and about understanding the value of life, and about kind of finding the child within himself again. And that's definitely reflected in the external character arc, where he goes to Neverland.
Yeah,
and he's Peter Pan, you know. And I, one thing that, you know, they could have done is they could have de-aged him. That would have been like a really obvious way of doing it, but they didn't. He's Peter. He is now an adult.
Yeah.
But his priority is still to go and save his children. And in doing so, he kind of learns to be a child again and to see things from their point of view. And it gets to the end where he, you know, figures things out a little bit. And I think that's a beautiful way of really, really combining the two, the internal and the external, and the two plots are intrinsically linked in a very obvious way. And I just think that that was a really successful version.
Yeah, oh, I've always loved that film.
It's a great film,
and it does do the adult child divide really, really well, with the massive irony of it being Peter Pan.
Exactly. I just think it's a wonderful story in that sense.
Yes. Just a brief mention, because we are coming to the end of the episode, but when you're looking at massive ensemble pieces, we've obviously mentioned the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but there's also things like the Game of Thrones books,
yes,
whereby there are dozens of points of view. And if you take someone like Sansa, who for the first like four books, when it's her point of view, she doesn't actually do very much physically.
No.
And her point of view can be interesting because the things that are happening around her, that's like the heart of the political intrigue. But she doesn't do very much. But her internal character journey, she is going on one very, very slowly and a bit frustratingly. And I have to admit, there are times when I've wanted to just skip her sections. But it is important because she's a fairly naive and clueless 13-year-old girl who goes on a hell of a journey ultimately.
And it definitely comes out of it as a different and much more developed person.
Yes. So, but most of her journey is internal. She doesn't go off and become an assassin like Arya does. She doesn't go on John's journey of finding his identity and becoming disillusioned with the whole idea of knightly ideals, etc. Or, you know, with Law and Order. or any of the others, in fact.
Weirdly enough, you know, well, we started off by saying how, you know, middle grade tends to be action-based and YA tends to be... internal based, and that's exactly kind of what's happening in the Aryas. Just they're like, nope, not dealing with this internal stuff. Just all external for me, even though she's got a lot of internal stuff. She kind of uses action to sort of escape it, whereas Sansa is in the complete opposite situation, where she's physically quite powerless for a lot of the books.
Yeah.
But internally, you know, she develops and gets quite powerful in that way. She figures out how the game works and she changes internally instead. And then you've got the typical, with both actually Robb Stark and also Jon Snow, where it's very much sort of coming into power sort of. In John's case, he's kind of dragged into it.
Kicking and screaming.
Kicking is like, wait, what? No!
Yeah, it's classic
now.
Hero's journey, isn't it? That's all very well done. Obviously, if you're going to write a magnum opus like A Song of Ice and Fire, then perhaps I would suggest you need George R. R. Martin's level of experience, probably.
Yeah.
To manage a cast that huge. But,
it is a huge cast. Obscenely large.
And ultimately, that's what makes it work. All characters ought to have their own character journeys, even if they're sort of secondary and tertiary characters, even if the reader never sees most of it. And even if they're just purely internal journeys, or purely external, or whatever, and they're only in for one scene, you should still feel like they're real people, in my opinion.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree with you. Before we go, though, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this week I believe you've got one for us.
I have. I'm actually kind of surprised to be recommending this, because I went in and saw it with no expectations whatsoever. I went and saw Shazam on Friday night, and it's really good. It's brilliant. I remember a really, really crap cartoon version of it from when I was sort of like 8 years old. I never read the graphic novels, but it is part of the DC universe, obviously. And I don't know what you know about Shazam, but basically, young boy gets imbued with the powers of the last wizard. And when he says the word Shazam, he becomes a 30-something-year-old adult male with Superman-like powers. And you can imagine how a 14-year-old boy acts with things like that. So. That was hilariously funny. And it was. A lot of it was played for laughs, but it was done in a really intelligent way. There were cheesy bits, but they were balanced by some grittier bits. And ultimately, it's a really great story of found family as well. and sharing power.
So, and you know how much we like found family.
Yeah, so I highly recommend that. It was a lot of fun. There were bits that it was laugh out loud funny in places. It really was. One of the better DC films that's come out recently.
Okay. Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.